Among the first activities undertaken by the revolutionaries at the beginning of the American Revolution was the invention of a new American tradition, that of writing and popularly ratifying constitutions for government. The United States Constitution was not the only such constitution. In fact, it was not the first one. One might argue it wasn't the most important one. In fact, it's not the oldest one still in effect. The American revolutionaries invented the idea of written constitutions adopted by the people's representatives. The first of those was the Virginia Constitution of 1776. The Virginia Constitution of 1776 was the first written constitution adopted by the people's representatives in the history of the world. This constitution was implemented on June 29, 1776, when Virginia's most popular and powerful revolutionary politician, Patrick Henry, was inaugurated. Here we see the fulfillment of Virginia's Republican independence. Virginia had staked out a claim to independence on May 15, 1776, when its Revolutionary Convention, the old colonial General Assembly meeting without the governor who had fled the colony, called for establishment of a Declaration of Rights, a written constitution, federal relations with whichever other colonies wanted them, and treaty relations with whichever foreign powers would have them. And as people in Williamsburg, the colonial capital, understood that event, it marked their independence. In fact, one observer said that that day they took down the Union Jack from upon the old colonial capital and ran up a Continental Union flag. This marked the time at which Virginia became permanently Republican. Virginia Constitution of 1776 was chiefly the work of George Mason, a delegate from the Potomac area in very northernmost Virginia. Mason was, as he put it, a man of 1688, and perhaps for that reason, the Constitution was to be preceded by a Declaration of Rights, just as in England, the Declaration of Right was adopted before William and Mary were brought into the kingdom to become the joint monarchs, king and queen, and only after that did they agree to Parliament's bill, the Bill of Rights. So we can see the Virginia Republican Convention's decision to adopt a Declaration of Right preceding a written constitution as being in keeping with the revolutionary tradition of the Whigs in England, as well as being the beginning point of the revolutionary tradition in America and the tradition of writing constitutions. The Declaration of Rights laid out the underlying principles of Virginia's Republican polity. First of those was popular sovereignty, the idea that the government is responsible to the people who have ultimate control of it and who periodically have control over the people who hold the important offices via the mechanism of elections. According to the Declaration of Rights, the government's responsibility is to protect citizens' rights. So in section one of the Declaration of Rights is the statement that men are born free and equal, and when they enter into a state of society, the government is responsible for protecting their rights. As this came from the committee charged with writing a Declaration of Rights, and that committee was chaired by Mason, it simply said that men were born free and equal and government was responsible for protecting their rights. But when the committee reported its product to the floor of the convention, the colonial treasurer, Robert Carter Nicholas, objected that, well, this couldn't be true because everyone knew that in Virginia people weren't born free and equal. In fact, some were slaves. And so he said if the convention adopted such language, it would immediately face a choice between, on one hand, ignoring its stated basic principles, and on the other hand, social convulsion. So he called for the insertion of the phrase when they enter into a state of society, thereby noting that the slaves were not going to be part of this society. They were not entering into the Lockean Compact. Another of the basic principles that was laid out in the Declaration of Rights was separation of powers, and the idea that neither the legislature nor the executive should be in control of the judiciary, but instead the judiciary should operate on its own. And of course, what this was a response to English history in the 17th century in particular. The Stuart kings had repeatedly intervened with the judges to wring from them results in legal cases that seemed inconsistent with law and certainly were inconsistent with the subject's liberty. And so here the Virginia Declaration of Rights said that the judiciary would be subject neither to the legislature nor to the executive. The Virginia Declaration of Rights did not merely lay out these basic political principles, however, it also elevated certain historic individual rights. Among those were the right to trial by jury, a right on which Virginians and other North American Whigs had been insisting ever more vociferously ever since 1765, the right to the free exercise of religion, the right to vote, and the freedom of the press. The free exercise of religion is an interesting issue because, again, Mason's committee reported a declaration, and the provision about religion in that draft said that the Virginians were going to be entitled to the fullest toleration in matters of religion. Well, Mason surely must have thought that extending full toleration to everyone in Virginia was the most liberal policy. And in fact, in England, this language had been adopted at the end of a long period of strife between Episcopalians and dissenting Protestants. So it seems a very liberal position to take, essentially, that you would not be persecuted for being any kind of Protestant you wanted to be. But the youngest member of the Virginia Convention, James Madison, age 25, objected at that point and said that it seemed to him that toleration had implications he couldn't accept. That is, of course, if I say that I'm tolerating your opinions, what I imply is that I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm going to put up with you for now. And so Madison said he preferred to say that Virginians were going to be entitled to the free exercise of religion. And once he had made this statement, Mason endorsed it, and the record says that the convention adopted it unanimously. So that became Virginia's position. Of course, we're familiar with this phrase, free exercise of religion, because Madison later, in a more important venue, would use the same language. The Virginia Constitution of 1776 said there would be three branches of the government. There would be an executive, a legislative, and a judicial branch. This, of course, was not consistent with the British system, where you did not have so clear a division. I mean, in theory, the king was the executive, but in practice, Parliament controlled most of the executive functions as well. Under the Virginia Constitution of 1776, while there was an independent executive, he was a very weak governor. He had no veto power. He served only a one-year term after being elected by a joint ballot of the legislature. And one would think that likely meant that he was, in some sense, subordinate to the legislature. And besides that, he had to cooperate with a council of state. So, in other words, he could only take significant decisions if he could bring a majority vote out of, or if he could secure a majority vote from the Council of State. This amounted to a very weak governorship. The second branch, the most important branch, was the legislative branch, which was bicameral. Here, Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's suggestion initiated the American tradition of calling the upper house of the legislature a senate. This language was borrowed from the ancient Roman Republican Senate. The lower house, however, would be essentially all-powerful because taxing and spending bills had to originate there, and if the governor and the council, the judges, were to be elected by joint ballot of the two houses, well, since the lower house drastically outnumbered the upper, most of the time its decisions would prevail, its preference would be vindicated. A second important constitution of the revolutionary period was that adopted by Pennsylvania in 1776. It was very unlike the Virginia one. First of all, the Pennsylvania response to difficulties with the governors in the colonial period was to eliminate the office of governor altogether. There was no governor in the Pennsylvania constitutional system created in 1776. Besides that, Pennsylvania created a unicameral legislature. And there was a council of censors whose job was to meet every 7 years, consider all the legislative product of the government over the previous period and decide which parts of that it would disallow. So this was amounted to a very democratic system in which you had a unicameral legislature essentially with both legislative and executive authority, but people disapproved of it from the beginning. A third important Republican constitution adopted by the American Republicans in the early part of the Revolutionary period was the New York Constitution of 1777. The chief author of that constitution was John Jay. Jay's New York Constitution is commonly seen as an outstanding advance over the Virginia and Pennsylvania models that had preceded it. If anything, if you could see the Pennsylvanians as much more democratically oriented than the Virginians, well, Jay's handiwork, it wasn't only Jay's, but chiefly Jay's handiwork, went in the other direction. First of all, there would be three branches, as in Virginia, but the governor would be a very strong governor. In fact, he would be akin to what we expect now when we think of governors. He would have an appointment power, which, for all intents and purposes, the Virginia governors didn't. He would be the chairman of a council of revision, which was essentially a veto committee. So in Virginia, they had no veto power at all. In Pennsylvania, there was no governor. Under Jay's constitution in New York, the governor would lead a committee, a small committee, that was given a power to veto legislative bills. The governor in New York was independently elected from the beginning. So again, unlike the Virginian one, who was essentially subordinate to the legislature, and perhaps most notably, where Virginia's governor had a one-year term and was subordinate to the legislature, and one might think then was constantly looking over his shoulder to see whether he was pleasing the legislators, and thereby deprived of independent will to some extent. New York's governor, independently elected by the people, had a four-year term. A final Republican constitution of this period that we need to consider is the one adopted by Massachusetts in 1780. Massachusetts' constitution was essentially the work of John Adams. Nowadays, we're commonly told that the oldest written constitution in the world is that of the United States, and that the federal government has this old constitution ratified by the people's representatives. Well, the U.S. Constitution was drafted at Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 and ratified in 1788. Massachusetts today still lives under the Constitution drafted mainly by John Adams in 1780 and ratified soon after its drafting. It was specially ratified by town meetings, at least that was the argument, although there's ground for dispute of the question whether all of it was actually approved by the town meetings. Ultimately, it was stamped with a seal of approval. And perhaps the most important feature, the most interesting feature of Massachusetts' 1780 Constitution was that it retained tax support for Puritanism. So Adams, who was himself not a Puritan, in fact not any kind of Christian, who, like other Enlightenment-inspired figures, believed that the central Christian doctrine of the Trinity was nonsensical and so believed only in a unitary God akin to the way that akin to the one that the Muslims or the Jews would define. There's one God, not three persons in a Trinity. Anyway, Adams decided to include this provision in the Constitution of Massachusetts. And why did he think that tax support for religion was important? Adams made a distinction between what he said was one religion in public and could be several in private. And the reason was that he thought it was imperative for society that people be have religion inculcated into them. And he thought this was true because although he had derived a morality without the aid of traditional religion, Adams believed that most people would not be moral if they did not believe there was going to be some future state of rewards and punishments. That is, Adams thought that there had to be some warning from a religion that if you didn't behave, God was going to punish you for it in the afterlife before most people would behave. So thinking that republicanism required belief in a future state of rewards and punishments, thinking that that was likely to come only from religion, thinking that many people would not be religious unless made to attend and participate, Adams opted to advocate continuation of the traditional Massachusetts requirement that people be religious, at least outwardly. This he thought was the underlying, as an underlying necessity for Republican government. So, besides that, there was discussion as Massachusetts was adopting its first Republican constitution of the question whether people would be required to take oaths of religious subscription and membership before they could hold public office. There were people who proposed that this be a general requirement for office holders, and ultimately it was included in the Constitution only for people in the very highest offices. Still, the point is that on one hand, we have states like Virginia where the colonial laws about religious taxes are going into desuetude during the revolutionary period, but then we have Massachusetts forthrightly staking out this position that Massachusetts is going to continue to require people to pay for Puritanism and at least to genuflect, well, they wouldn't have said that, but at least to give some show of subscription to it, even if that were not sincere. And Adams was not going to try to ferret out people who weren't authentically Puritan, as he was not himself, but he wanted people to be made to listen to the blandishments of ministers in hopes that they wouldn't rob or beat or rape or murder their neighbors. Very grim kind of attitude toward human psychology that Adams had, or I suppose one man's cynic is another man's realist. Besides these significant examples of Republican constitutions adopted in the earliest period, and I've mentioned Virginia's, New York's, Pennsylvania's, and Massachusetts, all the other states adopted written constitutions in that period too. In fact, as I alluded to before, Pennsylvania changed its constitution by the end of the Revolutionary period, and it was not the only state to do so. The two outliers, the two states that stood outside this trend of writing new constitutions, were Connecticut and Rhode Island. They both decided simply to continue their colonial charters in force. However, what they required was that people no longer take oaths to the king, but instead take oaths to the state. Each of them was going to have that substitute for the king in government oaths.